Brother T, yes, brother?
Yes, Ryan.
Good time of music. Bonus feature on the disc is Just Listen. So just listen to what they have to do. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Orchestra, so this is a slightly different version of it, but a lot of the same guys that played on the session are here. Jeff and I, of course, played on the record. Jeff played all the guitars, I played most of the piano, except the tough stuff. So that was the opening Homestead theme. This one's called Make Your Mark.
Thank you.
Next one is the buddy theme of Harlow and Spot. So
this is where they meet.
This is where they meet.
Thank you.
Last bit of film music from the film, Goodbye Spot. I think honestly, a big part of that is because you know the 75-piece orchestra isn't here, so you end up with what kind of ends up to be a Irish bar band, which is not a bad thing. It's a pretty good sound, but yeah, there is, you know, because the movie has those folky down home. There's some country and some Western influences to the score, so yeah, those are Scots-Irish influences, and I think when you strip out the horns and all that stuff, then yeah, you end up with this. Definitely it's something that those the rhythms and the plaintive, homey melodies are definitely, you know, one of the many cultures that we referenced in this film.
There's been a lot of iconic music that have come from Disney films, Disney animated films, Pixar animated films over the years. I know as a musician and composer, it's an impossible task to say, hey, sit down and write something iconic for me right now. But you guys have done that with this music. Can you talk about the challenges of writing music for Pixar, Disney animated films?
Well, thanks for that, first of all.
Yeah.
Right from the start, John Lasseter said, we want this thing to stand up on its own melodically. the way he put it was, he said, I want people to look at the poster in 5 years and hear the music. I want melodies attached to these characters that will stay in the viewers' heads long after the film is over. And like you said, given the legacy of this company, there was a very high bar. But once they set it, we tried our very hardest to meet it. And the first thing up was melodies. And the filmmakers were very clear, we don't want textural music or wallpaper orchestra music. We want straight on direct melodies that everyone can take home with them. So hopefully that's what we did. We worked hard to get it there.
Is that the secret, that sort of you need to find music that matches the characters, the story, so that's how it becomes iconic, because of the association that the audience has with this film, with the stories of the characters, that music stays in their head for generations?
Yeah, it's got to, and we've spent a lot of time, writing a good melody is hard enough, but then writing a good melody that is Arlo, that's the thing that took us, and we spent weeks, months even, writing just melodies. I think we were on the film really full time for 9 months. I think we didn't even really start writing scenes for 3 months. We spent 3 months writing melodies that we'd be, oh, that's beautiful, but then you'd look at the picture for a week and go, no, it's just not, it's not him. It's got to have all these qualities. And the step one is to get to know the director's vision of the film and the story and really know from the inside. That's where the music's got to come from, and it's got to be just locked into that, so that with the poster, with this picture, and this music, it's just everyone knows that it's the right thing, and that is the really difficult thing. But yeah, Pixar, that's what Pixar is, and that's what we set out to accomplish. So thank you for your kind words. That means a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you.
I'd love to ask the members of the band, because so many musicians have said, that you can sit down and you can play anything. But to sit down and play something and infuse it with the emotion that is followed through the visual grammar and the animation grammar, that's entirely different. How do each of you tap into to get the emotion to fill this music?
Our own heart. Right here.
Yeah, kind of a microcosm of what Michael's just saying about you have to understand the composer's vision, what they're trying to convey with the picture. It helps if they've written something beautiful, which they have, and makes sense, especially on your instrument. And then you also work on it. You'll do a take, and I'll say, okay, that was good, and I tried it this way. You do it a different way, and you both work to hone it until, and everyone can feel it. As soon as it's right, everyone goes, that's the one, that's the thing. So, okay, that was good, move on to the next take, and you try and figure it out, and you develop a sense of what it is.
Yeah, it is this bizarre alchemy where it's true. I mean, just playing, Gabe could play fiddle beautifully, could play that melody in 10 different ways, but there's one way that we all sat and watched the picture and went, that's the one. Mm-hmm. That's the one that is the scene. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating, and even after Jeff and I have done this for a long time, and so have all these guys, but there's a bit of magic to it, and you do all the work and all the preparation, but then the thing that happens that really locks it in is something that's really hard to define.
How much freedom do the musicians have going from the idea of the song to building it into a 75-piece, orchestra? How much freedom do they have to kind of ad-lib a little bit while you're trying to figure it out?
Well, in this score, there's certain roles where there's room for that kind of freedom, but the orchestral basis is pretty set. Once we've composed it and it's been orchestrated, that's a pretty set thing. And just getting that to be a beautiful thing is a challenge, even though it's the same notes each time. Then when you get into kind of what all these guys do, there is some room to move around. Some instruments lend themselves to that more than others. The more folky instruments lend themselves more to a kind of freedom. So fiddle, we often said, well, Gabe, what do you want to do here? What would you do? Or can you give us some more double stops, or Mike said, more down home, And same, Quinn came in with a truck full of percussion stuff from all over the world, and we'd say, try that, no, try that, no, and we'd go back and forth. So with certain things, there's a lot of freedom, but the kind of boat that the whole thing floats in is the orchestra, and we take all the time to write it and orchestrate it properly, and then we get some freedom on top.
I want to talk about Quentin, because the movie obviously takes place, if we're not necessarily in a prehistoric time, because the premise is that the dinosaurs are living, you know, among us, and this time, like, the roles are inverted, but
right.
How important was it to inject that we're actually 65 million years ago through the percussion, through all these sounds that I've never heard before? It almost sounds like I'm in a cave, and that would be like a caveman would be playing those little noises that he was making with his unique instruments.
Right. Yeah, but that, in fact, that was what we wanted to do, was have this sense from the percussion of the elemental. So we wanted stone and wood and glass. So rather than having a marimba, let's say that's, you know, a classical marimba or something you'd hear in a band, be like a marimba that's made of stones. So it had we wanted to be very careful. We didn't want it to sound super, you know, primitive and ancient, but we didn't want it to sound new. We were trying to make, you know, because it's such a unique world that Pixar created here with this world. So it's not really anywhere or any time, but it's what it is on the screen, and that's what we had to chase. But yeah, that's what we did. We tried to, without getting cliche and using instruments that people might normally reach for when there's the dinosaur time, we tried to do things that had a union with the earth and the ancientness. Yeah.
Can you show us the weirdest instrument? Like the most
the show on his layer.
Really weird stuff. We needed a truck to bring in.
those are goat
nails, right?
These are moth cocoons on my ankle.
Moth cocoons?
Yeah.
Those are goat nails that he's got up. No goats were harmed in the process. They donated them willingly. Yeah. Just their toenails.
It reminds me of a very Afro-Cuban influence.
Yes.
Like, when you hear bands like Old Latin, for example. But again, going back to the strings, I'm hearing what my local Irish would play.
Yeah.
Did you find yourself trying to find a neutral ground between those two worlds?
Definitely. I mean, that we didn't want it to be anywhere or any time. So I think when you hear this final recorded score, it's got flavors from a lot of those places that you've identified and other places, but it hopefully makes this blend that's a unique, that's what you're seeing on screen, something different that's not a specific place, it's not a specific time, but there are elements from all the things that made up the film.
Speaking of that, though, you know, I mean, when you look at the movie, it's a rogue picture. It's, you know, it's got an epic scale, but at the same time, it's one of the most intimate things that Pixar's ever done. I mean, you must have had some interesting conversations with Peter just trying to zero the Venn diagram to, you know, how to do the score for this thing.
Well, there are definitely dynamics play a huge part in how we presented the score. And like you said, from these very intimate moments between Arlo and Spot and just the two of them in this vast, amazing wilderness, to these things that are much bigger because they represent much bigger changes in Arlo's life and maybe him breaking away or something. So it's one of the fun things we get to do when we're writing music is to play with dynamics all the way from a couple of us here from this kind of a sound to 85 or 90 pieces just wailing away. Not all productions lend themselves to that kind of coloring musically, but this one did, and it was fun for us to take Reel 5, for example, where Arlo runs up the mountain, and we're huge, and it's big, and he sees home, and then just a few minutes later, it's very small and quiet as he realizes there's a separation. So it's part of the fun of a project like this for us.
When you guys, I was just saying, when you guys get the film, how far along the process is it completed, and because it may be not quite completed, how much do you balance what you've got from the script or the written word versus the visual in terms of how you create the tone?
It's a great question. The fact is, Jeff and I never saw the finished film until the premiere. So we literally went to the premiere and went, oh, that's cool. But, you know, this is how animation works. I mean, it's almost like a radio play in a way first, because they record the voices, then they animate to that. But the animation starts literally like, you know, pencil sketches on storyboarding, where we would get the film, but it'd be, you know, Arlo and Spot, like pencil sketch, like frozen for 5 seconds, then moving like this for another five. So it, obviously it starts there, and it starts to get more motion, and, you know, in the year that we were working on it, it got more and more fine and finer and finer. But many of the scenes weren't finished at all by the time we even recorded them, never mind wrote them. So that's when your director is invaluable, and somebody like Pete, who had, you know, he knew exactly what it was going to look like and what it was going to mean and how it needed to feel. So he would describe that to us. He would have to paint that picture for us, what wasn't on the screen in front of us.
An Italian question.
Yeah.
Am I wrong if I say that I hear some influence from Ennio Morricone in this music? What do you think?
Well, there was a couple of Western themes that I guess would harken back. Although he usually did a more stripped down thing, but I would assume you're meaning the Western things, and that was sort of like a little theme inside a theme, or a moment inside a bigger moment for us to just kind of go off a couple times when the T-Rexes with the cowboy hat show up, and we did that sort of thing. And I think that for all the film culture, anything Western, just because Morricone was there at the beginning with those iconic films, he comes to mind.
Yeah, he's been one of the he's one of the guys who created that sound. So yeah, definitely an influence. Yeah.
You guys, I don't know if you saw The Lion King, but where Simba loses his father, it's a similar situation in here. And I remember that score really, at least at the time, because I was a kid, not to date myself, but it really moved me. And as an adult, this score in that particular situation, it was moving to the point it was quite uncomfortable. I was trying to hold it in so my nephew wouldn't see me. and he would, you know, I'm supposed to put up, kind of like an example of, don't cry, puppy, you know, that kind of thing. Did you guys see the film, or any other Disney film for that matter, to maybe, I don't know, grab an idea of the level of pride that they would expect?
I mean, yeah, we've definitely seen that film. We've seen all the, especially Pixar movies, or the
Disney kids.
Family. Yeah, we both have kids. I have a 5-year-old and a 10-year-old. I mean, my 5-year-old sat on my lap while I was writing half of this, and he, you know, because his favorite toy that he carries around is a dinosaur, and now he carries around an Arlo. But, you know, so it meant a lot. It meant a lot to us. There's a big connection for us, just for our families, not only as grown men who might feel like that, but just, yeah, having our kids and having seen all those films with our kids, we know, yeah, there's moments where you really want to hit the emotion, and the test audience is right there, your kids, so, and they're brutal. the most brutal critics. So, yeah, it meant a lot to us for that.
So now, having said that you wrote part of this with your 5-year-old on your lap, is there anything that got incorporated where your 5-year-old just went and was very excited in the creative process?
Yeah, definitely. No, I learned about the film by watching him watch it. And, you know, things that, you know, when you're older and numb to things, you see a 5-year-old watch this movie and, you know, dad being swept away was like, you know, he would ask me for days after. He only saw it in parts sometimes because I only had parts, and he, like, is Arlo's daddy okay? Like, I really, like, it sort of became more moving for me because I was like, okay, it's really, you know, means something to him. So definitely, yeah, the things and scenes that I wasn't sure about, he would laugh, or his 10-year-old would come in, they would just watch and laugh their butts off, and so yeah, it really helped me understand the film.
Did Disney make your son sign an NDA?
I was just going to ask, you said you didn't actually get to see the full movie until the night of the premiere. Was there anything that particularly stood out to you that maybe you didn't think of while you were composing, or anything particularly move you?
I mean, I remember the one moment that we never got to see, and when Mike says we didn't see the whole movie, we saw the length of the movie, we just didn't see finished rendered sections sometimes. And the one thing we never got to see, and I remember we worked on it a lot, was when, spoiler alert, we realized that he's having a vision of his father, and that dad isn't really there, and that as he watches him walk away, he just vanishes into like rain. And we never saw that. Like we had all these crazy rough. It made it a little tricky for us to know where to change the music, where he vanished and stuff. And we never saw anything remotely close to what was finished until the premiere.
Yeah.
That one stands out to me as just trying to time it right and make the feeling right without anything actually being there.
Well, my jaw drops. I mean, watching that thing like with the Dolby Live, is that what it's called? Whatever it's called, the digital projection. Oh my God. I mean, I could not believe what I was seeing. It's so beautiful and stunning. And yeah, a lot of the times it's like, damn, why couldn't we see this while we were writing? It would have been easy. But because it is so emotional and so, it's just so incredible. So we had to get to that emotional place kind of with the help of Pete and our imaginations. But yeah, it was really amazing to see it finished.
Thank you guys.
Thanks for coming out.